I'll call the Public Safety Finance Committee to order. We had a bill that was scheduled for this morning on Governor Mahoney's bill. He's ill, so we took that off the agenda. That was on joint physical custody. But it'll be back. So today we're spending our entire hour on the Department of Human Rights for several reasons. I think the governor's budget comes out tomorrow, so we don't know what types of cuts he might recommend to all of the departments that are under the auspices of this committee. But we are bringing all the departments in to have a discussion about their budgets and what cuts this committee might recommend because of the unfortunate deficit that we're in. If you remember, members, last year we required the Human Rights Department to conduct an internal evaluation and to survey the clients, the people, the customers, basically, that file claims against the Department of Human Rights. You probably know that in 1996, that the Legislative Auditor's Report came out and had some specific recommendations of the department, so we may want to also revisit those recommendations and also the report that was filed by the department in response to that original Legislative Auditor's Report. So, we have a quorum already. Okay. Representative Haas moves approval of the minutes from March 4th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. So, we have with us this morning a representative from the Department of Administration that will talk to us about the evaluation that they provided, and I think we'll first hear from Commissioner Velma Corbell from the Department of Human Rights. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chairman Paymore. Good morning, committee members. Thank you for having us again so soon. We are glad to be here. I am going to defer to Judy Grew from the Department of Administration initially. Judy is going to talk about the process that we went through in order to formulate the survey, and then I would like to just address the recommendations and what the department has done to handle those, if that's okay with the committee.
Yeah, and members, I also, there are some individuals in the audience that would like to also testify about the Department of Human Rights, and some so we want to make sure we have ample time for that testimony. So, Commissioner, do you want to start? Okay.
Ms. Drew is going to start, Representative Tamar.
Okay. Ms. Drew, you want to identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Drew. I'm a management consultant with Management Analysis and Development in the Department of Administration. I'm here today to discuss the method for the survey of charging parties for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Management Analysis administered this survey under terms of an interagency agreement with the Department of Human Rights. And the survey questions were developed in consultation with the Department of Human Rights and the Minnesota House Public Safety Finance Division. The two survey instruments are shown in Appendix A and B of your report. I understand you all have been provided with a copy of that. The questions on that survey assess charging party satisfaction with human rights processes such as intake, investigations, conciliation, and appeals, as well as their overall satisfaction with the process. We conducted these surveys with all charging parties who filed charges or had their cases resolved in the two-year period between July 1, 2005 and June 30, 2007. 569 individuals were surveyed, and of these, 431 had a non-probable cause determination on their charges, and 138 had a probable cause determination. The surveys were conducted by U.S. Mail between August and October 2007, with an initial mailing and two follow-up mailings to non-respondents. The overall response rate on the survey was 44%. Upon concluding the survey, we produced a report of our impressions and recommendations and also met personally with members of the leadership team with the Department of Human Rights to discuss the survey findings.
Representative Paymore and committee members, then I would just continue the discussion unless there are questions of this group. Pardon me.
Well, I have two questions. Ms. Grew, I mean, I don't know if it was our fault or maybe there isn't any fault, but it just seems like that maybe you can address the issue that it seemed like the survey doesn't, there were some recommendations that you made, but I'm not sure how you get to the issue of really understanding if there is a problem with the way cases are handled, because it seemed like where probable cause was found, and I think you say this in your report, that people were tended to be more satisfied with the process, and when it wasn't, they weren't. But so that doesn't really tell us anything, does it?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, no, it doesn't tell you a lot. To hear, when you look at the pie charts showing the impressions of those who had non-probable cause and probable cause determinations, you find vastly different opinions on just about every dimension of the service that they received, including intake, which really shouldn't be any different between a person who eventually was going to have a non-probable cause versus a probable cause determination. That was the reason why, in the suggestions that I made to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and to the legislature, that a different type of evaluation be conducted, one which, where an independent investigator perhaps were to study the processes, especially on intake and investigation, and go through the records, go through the processes, and review the process in that way.
Did you, again, it was hard to discern from reading the report, but were there some for those people who were dissatisfied with the process, were there some trends that you saw that were problematic?
Again, the trends are different and the feedback is different depending on the outcome of the case for the individual. An overall trend amongst those who had non-probable cause determinations was a feeling that their case had not been appropriately investigated, that their witnesses hadn't been interviewed, for example, or a sense of lack of thoroughness in the process. However, we hear the contrary point of view from those who had probable cause determinations, providing compliments of how thorough the investigation was. So again, that doesn't lead you to a conclusive finding either way.
Okay. President Dominguez has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under your line item here, I don't know who could answer this, but under your line item here, it says return as undeliverable. Could you explain that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is on page 3 of your report.
Right.
Those were envelopes that we mailed out where a forwarding address for the charging party wasn't available, and so the envelope was returned to us as undeliverable.
Representative Dominguez.
Just one follow-up. Under your category of probable cause determination, you have 15. How does that come out if they haven't responded? There's no response, or no one got the mail. How did you come out with 15?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, 15 of the 138 individuals who had probable cause determinations, we were not able to reach them by mail.
Okay.
We made numerous attempts, but some people move and don't leave a forwarding address, and
right.
That line shows the folks who we could not locate. So there were 15 of those amongst the 138 probable cause.
I see what you're talking about now. Thank you.
Ms. Grudy, can you just briefly go through the recommendations that you made?
Okay.
And why?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
I would just like you to go through the recommendations based on the survey, why you made them.
The suggestions for, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the suggestions for process improvement begin on page 35 of your report. There were some suggestions submitted by charging parties themselves. One was a suggestion from a charging party that individuals receive more assistance and coaching throughout the process. Another one was that people be provided clearer or better information about the one-year statute of limitations on filing charges, so that may be made fairly clear to individuals up front. And another charging party suggested that people be given better process guidance as they go through the process, say perhaps to be shown a drawing or a map showing the steps of the process as they go through so they understand where they are at throughout the process. Some of the suggestions that we made upon reviewing the findings was, first of all, to institute an evaluation process that evaluates each process at its conclusion. This perhaps might get you around the problem of people evaluating the process after the fact, after they've learned their determination, and that knowledge of the determination perhaps coloring their perception of the actual process. So perhaps what we could do is survey individuals upon conclusion of the intake process about their satisfaction with intake, upon the conclusion of the investigation process, but before a determination is made. That might help you get better data from charging parties as they move through the process. Another recommendation or suggestion was to re-examine the department's neutral role in advising charging parties in retaining private counsel. This is a conclusion that I formed upon reading the open-ended comments from charging parties on the survey, where numerous individuals were expressing disappointment that the Department of Human Rights hadn't been an advocate for them. And some people also indicating disappointment that they hadn't hired an attorney to represent them throughout the process. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights makes numerous attempts, both in its written communications and its intake process, to make it clear to charging parties that their role is not to be an advocate for the charging party. Their role is to neutrally investigate the charges and to be rather objective on both sides. Yet we still find that charging parties are disappointed that they don't have an advocate for them at the table. I thought perhaps a way to get around that was to advise charging parties to retain private counsel as they go through the process. finally, the last recommendation has to do with an objective evaluation of the investigation process and perhaps other processes in the Department of Human Rights. Given that obtaining the feedback from the charging parties themselves is helpful, it leaves many questions unanswered about the quality of the process, about the details of the investigation, and an independent evaluation or investigation could help answer some of those questions.
Ms. Drew, how would that happen? When you say an independent investigation?
An independent evaluation can be sponsored by the Minnesota Legislature. Our organization, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, often is asked to do a review of the operations of an organization. I think routinely with the legislature, those tasks are often assigned to the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Well, and that happened over 10 years ago, and the issues that came up there had more to do with how long it took to dispose of a case and issues like that. But how would you get to how cases are qualitatively handled? That's what we asked you to do, mm-hmm. and we didn't get there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to clarify that our role in this process was to be the administrators of a feedback survey. If there was any confusion, I apologize. We weren't asked to conduct any type of within-office evaluation of those actual processes of the Department of Human Rights. So in other words, we didn't form a study team that went to the Department of Human Rights and studied how they conduct their business, how intake is conducted, how investigations are run. That's the type of objective investigation that we're talking about in this suggestion. Is for someone to go out, look at best practices in the field, what are some of the hallmarks of a good investigation process, the hallmarks of a good intake process, and compare those best practices to the practices in play at the Department of Human Rights. That was not part of the scope of our work, so we were recommending that that might be some follow-on work.
Okay. Representative Mendez, do you have any questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking through this. In your survey, was there any question as far as the assistance for the department to have more employees to help with this work? Was there any question in the survey to that effect?
Ms. Drew.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we didn't have a specific question about the adequacy of staffing, but you can infer from responses relating to the amount of time that was sent to you or how thorough different items were that some of those issues might be addressed with better staffing. I did receive a few open-ended comments where people said the person didn't seem to have time for me, my calls weren't returned. They appear to be rushed, but it's hard to form a clear sense of that from those open-ended comments.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, so we were coming to some type of conclusion that the staff was overburdened by a lot of this work that's being done and they needed more staff.
That's true.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that isn't a clear finding coming from the research. As I indicated, there were a number of open-ended comments that referenced the staff being overburdened. That is the observation of the charging party going through the process. A more definitive determination might come from a more thorough internal review of the office's staffing complement.
Should be noted that I don't have the statistics in front of Gary, maybe Carter, I don't know if you do, but we have the department has financially, the legislature has not been increasing its budget over the years. In fact, it's declined significantly, I think, in 2003. I don't know if you have. Maybe we can get that information, but anything else for Ms. Grew at this point? Okay. Well, Commissioner, do you want to, I don't know if you had a presentation planned or do you want to respond to
Ms. Paymore and committee members, just some general comments. First of all, I'd like to thank the Department of Administration and the Management Analysis Division. They did a great job. The department was not seriously involved except with providing lists of charging parties, et cetera, for them to mail the survey to, but they did a great job. They kept us apprised of the timing of what was happening. So I just want to thank them for the very professional job that they did in helping to put their report together. But I also like to respond to several comments that I heard as Ms. Grew was presenting and some of the questions that were asked. This survey really confirmed the impressions that the department has every day when it does this work. Individuals who have a probable cause determination are generally more satisfied with the work that they've gotten and the results of the investigation. Individuals with a no probable cause, it's usually just the opposite. And in asking to survey charging parties, we ended up with really a set of perceptions by people and not so much facts. And I think the only way to really get at the facts in terms of solid information about the quality of the investigation is to actually have people who are professional investigators perhaps involved in some sort of analysis in the future. But I do want to say this, that the quality of the investigation process in the department is really legitimized when we talk about the cases, whether they've been a probable cause determination or no probable cause determination. When these cases go to court, if a PC has held up in the department, if the cases go to court that's substantiated in court, in district court or in front of the administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearing. If there's been a no probable cause determination in terms of the thoroughness and quality of the investigation, those cases are not taken up by attorneys or they're dismissed as soon as they make it into court. So the department employs all of the rules of civil procedure that are required. We employ all of the rules of due process that are required. So in terms of thoroughness and quality, I don't think that there would be many folks who would say that doesn't happen. Now, in terms of timing, absolutely, I think that's a factor of the number of staff in the department, because I think it would go, you know, it doesn't need to be said that if we had more staff, we could probably do things more quickly. But in terms of thoroughness and quality, I would have to say that there are things out there that point to the fact that the department is thorough and the quality of the investigations is very good. The other thing that I'd also like to point out in terms of advising charging parties and potential charging parties of their right to have an attorney representing them through any aspect of proceeding that's in front of the department. As Ms. Kuhn mentioned, we do let charging parties know that several times throughout the process. And what we do find is that charging parties who have availed themselves of counsel through this process do tend to do better, because I believe, and I don't have anything that empirical to suggest this, that attorneys are helping charging parties read the documents, make sure that the timing to get things into the department is occurring. But we don't miss an occasion to communicate to a charging party or potential charging party that they have the right to have an attorney representing them in this process. And I also have to believe, again, no empirical data to suggest this, that attorneys who take cases from charging parties probably already have a good idea, because they've already done their own analysis of which cases have the best chance to succeed before the department. And so that may be why some charging parties come to the department without counsel, but they're certainly advised, if I could use that word, that they have the right to have a representative in the proceeding. I'd also like to just mention, in terms of the recommendations that came from the Department of Administration and also the suggestions that came from charging parties for process improvements, that we have looked at all of those and have responded to those, and just so that I could put that in the record as well. In order to comply or respond to these the issues of assistance and coaching and information and process guidance, the department has done several things. We have created, really expanded and refined the community resource list that we're using now, that is composed of organizations that provide services to many different kinds of individuals in the community. And with some minor tweaking, that report or that document should be up on our website by March 15th this year, and also available upon request to anyone who wants a hard copy of that. That same resource list is going to be used as a mailing that the department is going to do in order to start education sessions for these community organizations, so that they can learn what the investigation process is and be able to provide information to their constituents. And that we have a goal to have the education sessions actually up and running by June 1st of this year. It just takes some putting together of curriculum and getting that process really nailed down. In terms of information, the department has always had a list of frequently asked questions on its website that provides information about the process, about really what you need to evaluate on your own to determine if you even want to come to the department and bring a case to us. That information is currently on the website, but it has been refined, enhanced, and also placed on the website in a prominent location. So for individuals who are interested, you can go to the website. It's one of the first places you, as soon as you pop the website up, it's one of the first places you can click. Within the FAQ section, there's also a flow diagram that brightly colored flow diagram that explains the process in pictures and also includes information, again, about the availability or the right that that a charging party has to have an attorney represent them through the process. The that flow diagram that explains the process, in addition to being on the website, that is currently available on the website, we are also going to be mailing that flowchart process with information about the fact that charging parties have a right to have an attorney represent them. That's going to be mailed with questionnaires to potential charging parties, not just the charging parties, but individuals who contact the department for information when we do some initial analysis of their allegations. We send out what's called a questionnaire, and so we're also going to include that flow diagram with the with that. So that's in terms of responding to the suggestions from the charging parties and also from administration, because we do understand that perception is based in reality, and if there's a way that we can provide additional information about the process and still maintain the neutral position of investigator, we want to do that, because again, you know, the department also has a responsibility to protect individuals who are accused from wholly unfounded charges of discrimination. So it's a very fine line to walk, but we do understand that there's a need for more information.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. At this point, let's hear from, we'll have a little public testimony. They can respond either to the report or other issues. Nicole, do you have a question?
Very quickly for either the commissioner or the witness from the Department of Administration, how much was appropriated to do this study, or how much was spent to perform this study and evaluation?
Representative Paymar, Representative Post, there was no money appropriated to do this study, and the cost is actually in the report, in the first page, the cover page of the report. Cost the department $16,340. And that doesn't take into consideration some of the copying, the mailing, some of the extra work that the Department of Administration had to undertake to get this report done.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman, I would just note that, you know, that doesn't sound like an astronomical amount of money for a study like this, but I'm just not, I kind of agree with you. I'm not sure that it tells us much. I'm not terribly surprised to find that people who had a probable cause finding were more satisfied than people who didn't have a probable cause finding. I would guess if you talk to victims in the criminal system, those who had a case actually charged out against the person who perpetrated the crime against them might be more satisfied with the criminal justice system than those who didn't. Again, I'm just not sure that I'm not sure there's a lot here. I was just curious about the cost. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and that's going to close up. You know, I could take some responsibility maybe for failing to do that, because now hearing from Ms. Grew, it sounds like we might have been able to do this in a different way that might have been more helpful, and so. What can I say?
I mean, it's interesting, and it's good information, Mr. Chair. I'm just not... It's somewhat intuitive.
I get it. Okay, Mr. Walker's here, but I don't know if you wanted to make any comments first, but we'll just hear from the... if people want... And Commissioner, and then Ms. Grew, if you could just stay... you don't have to stay there, but and Commissioner, if you want to just have a seat somewhere, and we'll call you back up maybe if we need to. Who would like, is there anyone that would like to speak first? There's no real, if you could try to limit your comments. I don't know how many people, can people raise their hands if they want to speak, just so I know? Okay. So there's about a half a dozen people. If you could keep your comments maybe to a few minutes.
Yeah.
So if there's any questions of you, and also we need you to introduce yourself for the record and go through the chair when you speak, please, just because we're taping this.
My name is Jeannie Zapata, and I want to thank you, Michael Paymar, Chair. I find everything that was just said totally different than what I've experienced. First of all, attorneys do not want your case or even have anything to do with you until you've went through the steps of the Human Rights Department, the EEOC, or the Department of Labor, which all work together. Also, it depends on how many people work at
a certain place. You may have to go to the EEOC if you have a big employer, okay? So they write you a letter and they say that they're doing business with the human rights to their job sharing. So in my case, I was working for a big company, and I was working with all men. I had a drunken foreman assault me. I turned him into his foreman and to the EEO of our company, and the EEO of our company stood back and let these two men harass me. They harassed me so much that within 3 months they fired me. I had worked there 10 years. I hadn't had one speck of anything on my record. I was always at work, perfect attendance, perfect performance. Anyway, I bring this case to the EEOC, and they write a letter to 10 days after they get their complaint. They send it to the company and says, this is the charge that you have up against you. This woman is saying this, and do not retaliate to her, okay? And they charge them with 3 different counts. After they received that letter, then they really retaliated, and then they fired me. Then the EEOC had to amend the first charge, so they added fired on it. Then they sat on my case for 8 months and had me believing that they were checking my case out. During that time, they never called one of my witnesses, not one. After 8 months, they gave me my case back because I kept on prodding them to, because I wanted an attorney. And they gave me, after 8 months, they gave me this letter that said no probable cause. And I said, you got to be kidding me. I called Wisconsin, where they have their district office, and I made them change that letter. And I said, you don't need to write no probable cause. How will I go to an attorney with a no probable cause? No attorney will take your case with a no probable cause. They have no right to put that on there. Everyone, if they feel that they have a lawsuit, has a right to go to an attorney, as far as I'm concerned. And by this, the Human Rights Department put me no probable cause. We can't sue for you because the company that you work for is an entity of the government. Now, I haven't only experienced discrimination, harassment, but I have 2 Mexican daughters that both have went through the Human Rights Department, and they didn't do anything for either one of my daughters. And it was dead wrong what happened to my daughter. She was working in a beauty shop. She sold the most products in a whole beauty shop. She worked in Forest Lake, where it's all white people. She sold the biggest amount of products, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars of hair products. And one of the girls said to Selena, she said, Selena, you're going to love your check today. And Selena said, why? She said, well, we got our bonus for selling products. So Selena opens up her check, and she gets $30. This other girl said, well, I got $130. She didn't sell as much as my daughter did. Then another girl that hadn't sold any product at all, she got $40. So Selena, with feeling that she's been unjustly, she went to her leader of her job and asked them about that wage. And what happened was, they fired her. They said, you're not supposed to talk about your wage. And she said, well, I didn't talk about it. The other girls told me. She was the only one fired. She got fired, and she turned it into the Human Rights. They sat on it. They said there was no just no probable cause. You know, you can get an attorney if you want to. So my daughter looks for other jobs. In the meantime, one of the jobs called her old place of employment, and they gave a bad review of Selena. Selena met up with this lady one day, and she said, you know, I can't understand why you didn't hire me. And this woman said, because that salon said a lot of bad things about you. So she turned it again into Human Rights Department, and again, they found no problem. Now, I'm just saying, they have like 15,000 to 20,000 complaints a year. So if they went through 569 in 2 years, that isn't a very good amount. Because you'd have 40,000 complaints. And this is hurting people. It's making businesses feel they can do whatever they want to people. And I'm just talking about employment. We've got housing here, too. Housing and every other thing.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Anyone else? Welcome to the committee,
well, thank
please.
Thank you, Chairman Paymore, and thank you, committee. My name is Donya Johnson, and after I looked at the survey, I had the same remarks that you had, and so you put it very well. And I think if you're going to spend the money on this, do it so that you're getting information back that you can apply. The commissioner talked about things on the website. We all know about the digital divide. I think that is horrific to count on the website for information. I was looking at your statute for 363A06 and the powers and duties of the commissioner. And she had talked about developing and disseminating technical assistance. That's been in here in your statute. And I need to know why it hasn't already been applied. The other thing is that we need to apply the whole statute, not just certain sections. And in your own statute, you say you're putting emphasis on three of the things that is not going to work. And I want to confirm Jeannie's feeling. I've worked in this community and community organizing all my life. And people are in pain every day. And it is ridiculous that you have a profit that is really putting the burden on the person that's already in pain. The process that we have right now is reactive. You have a wonderful statute. Everybody that I send this to in the United States looks at it and says, Minnesota is so forward in the statute until they get to the section that says in performing these duties, the commissioner should give priority to these duties clauses in 8, 9, and 10, and duties in section 36A36. You're not even doing a compliance with 363A36. There's complaints from contractors every day. I work with people, I know my neighbors are contractors, and they have issues with the state, with the city, and the county, and nothing is done. And so we need to do something. I take this, I got this right from Minnesota North Star. I've sent this to 100 people on my email list, and I've told them to send it to 100 people. Because it needs to get out what's here and what we're not doing. And so you're talking about cutting budgets to this department? That's ridiculous. Do you care about all the citizens of this state? Or is it the few that already have the money and the good old boys club?
Thank you. We have a question for you if you want to rip them close.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. I guess my question, or I think I want to try to understand your testimony. I think what I'm hearing you say is that it would be your preference to see the Department of Human Rights serve more of an advocacy role as opposed to a neutral forum to resolve allegations of discrimination. Am I understanding your testimony correctly?
Ms. Johnson.
That's what your statute says. It's not my implication. This is what it said it's going to do. And the section she's talking about putting in place now, in June or whatever date she gave, should have already been in place. And that's the section 16 of that statute.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson, for your testimony. Anyone else wish to address the committee? McDonald, welcome to the committee.
Chairman Paymar, members of the committee, my name is Edward McDonald. I'm here to speak on behalf of a group called the Equality Campaign. The Equality Campaign is a dedicated group of residents from throughout the metro area committed to strengthening the state of Minnesota's human and civil rights enforcement system to ensure that Minnesota maintains its rightful place as a nation leader with ensuring equality of access and opportunity for all of its residents. The intent of my comments are not to offend anyone, call into question the dedication of the people providing human and civil rights enforcement services for our state. My intent is to provide a big picture view of what is happening with our state's human and civil rights enforcement system. First, Minnesota has always been a national leader in civil and human rights enforcement, led by Governor Freeman and Anderson, and a bipartisan state legislature. Minnesota had adopted anti-discrimination statutes before our nation adopted its civil rights laws. Minnesota Human Rights Act, as it has evolved over the past 50 years, is one of the most progressive in the nation. Many believe that our National Civil Rights Act was modeled after Minnesota's Progressive Anti-Discrimination Act because of leaders like Roy Wilkins, Hubert Humphrey, and Walter Mondale's involvement in the national civil rights movement. In addition, Minnesota is a national leader in opening its borders to resettle refugees to help them escape places in the world that have little regard for human rights. The freedom from discrimination public policy of the state of Minnesota states, it is the public policy of the state to secure for persons in the state freedom from discrimination in employment, housing and real property, public accommodation, public service, educational, personal and commercial credit, trade or business or provisions of services because of those persons' race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, disability, status with regards to public assistance, sexual orientation, and age. Our state believes that such discrimination threatens the rights and privileges of inhabitants of this state and menace the institutions and foundation of democracy. It is also the public policy of the state to protect all persons from wholly unfounded charges of discrimination. Minnesota's human rights statute has 19 administrative requirements. When applied, it ensures compliance with civil rights and equal opportunity laws. However, the state only allows the Department of Human Rights to give administrative priority to three of those functions, and the state's financial appropriations only support the administrative application of those three functions. The priority functions are receive complaints of discrimination, investigate to determine probable cause exists, and to oversee affirmative action requirements on procurement contracts. The non-priority administrative requirements would make our human and civil rights enforcement system more proactive. But not making these remaining requirements a priority of the enforcement system is one that only reacts to rights violations and puts a burden of proof squarely on the complainant, which is cost prohibitive and highly intimidating for many. While we have enjoyed great success and progress over 50 plus years with establishing human and civil rights enforcement systems and policies, our efforts to fully administer the application of these laws have become stagnant, lackadaisical, and dysfunctional. This stagnation and dysfunction can be attributed in part to the way things are trending at the federal level with human and civil rights enforcement. However, and more importantly, our state has not responded proactively to the changes that are occurring at the federal level. For example, at the federal level, in a 2005 Federal Commission on Civil Rights study found, civil rights and equal opportunity enforcement has received no net increase in funding for nearly 15 years. The federal government has restructured its federal civil rights and enforcement system, resulting in fewer regional offices to serve local communities. The federal government, through various court decisions related to equal opportunity and civil rights laws, have deferred to state to define their approach for civil rights and equal opportunity enforcement. The federal government still mandates civil rights and equal opportunity enforcement, but provide no resources directly or specifically to support enforcement. All these actions and others are returning civil rights enforcement back to a pre-civil rights era state jurisprudence. and the state have yet to respond with redefining our approach to address this reality. At the state and local levels, we have identified the following issues. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights has not received a net increase in funding for over 15 years, even though it still receives a high volume of complaints or formal contacts. A 1996 evaluation and the most current evaluation of the department by the Legislative Auditor's Office found that it does not perform its statutory duties. The Minnesota Legislature and Supreme Court conduct an examination showing that racial bias exists throughout our state judicial system.
Mr. McDonald, you're going to have to wrap up because
okay.
I want to hear from other testifiers.
Quickly, at the more local level, the city of St. Paul cut its Human Rights Department budget by 50%. The city of Minneapolis have had four or five directors in 3 years to run its department. It forecasts elimination of the department by 2010. There are 57 human rights commissions in the state, local commissions, that receive complaints but are run by volunteers or have no staff, and they are not connected to our state office. This dysfunctional system used to enforce human and civil rights laws in the state results in rapidly growing disparities and eating away at our superior quality of life. We hope that this is just the beginning of your efforts to look at a restructuring of the approach so that Minnesota can gain its rightful place as a national leader in advancing equality.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. McDonald. Representative Cornish has a question of you.
Mr. Chairman, members, what's the witness team?
Edward McDonald.
Mr. McDonald, how do you keep from the pendulum swinging too far the other way? In other words, if there's some employees out there that should be booted out, fired, disciplined, this and that. There's some that bring completely bogus complaints to the Human Rights Commission because they're dissatisfied with the answer they got, which was probably right. There's also people completely on the other end of the scale that are outright discriminated against. But if we start financing and turn it into an advocacy group for somebody and make it completely open access, how are we going to keep it from turning too much the other way and swamping with complaints, knowing that they can go there and get advocates and have a, you know, free complaint and just be a pain in the backside to their employer who probably fired them rightly? How do we keep it from going too far the other way? I mean, how are we going to distinguish that? If
Mr. McDonald.
Chairman Paymar, representative, I don't think the group is suggesting that the pendulum is swinging one way or the other. And what you're hearing from people here is that the state has put forth a very progressive, balanced human civil rights statute. But the priority is one where the system is reacting to complaints versus being more proactive and working with businesses to, in fact, examine how they are dealing with the fair employment or the protection of employees to help them prevent the potential for a case of discrimination being brought against them. In fact, this statute really does give the Human Rights Department the opportunity through educational means and other approaches to even assist employees who may not understand what those civil rights protections are. And we're not deploying our Human Rights Department in that manner. We're simply basically sitting back and allowing people to come forward and complain. And I believe that the reality is that they are so overwhelmed that the system is one that may not lend itself to providing as much assistance as it possibly can to people. And I don't mean that as a slight, but I think there's more that we can do on the front side preventing acts of discrimination if we were to fully deploy the statute. That would help businesses and others and balance the whole thing out.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Anyone else wish to testify?
Really quick,
Representative Haas.
Thank you. I'll just say it really fast. There is a trend in my district in St. Cloud. We are now having a state a human rights office as a region, and our area is helping defray the cost of that, most of the cost, I suspect. And so it's an interesting model that you should have. I think it might be all of it, but, you know, all of it never works. You know, there's still some cost to the state, but, I mean, the attempt was to be all.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Anyone else wish to address the committee? Come on up. Unfortunately, we're going to have to get out of here by 9:30 and be on time because they bumped up a session, I think. 9:30. Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Frank J. Brown. I'd like to thank Representative Paymar and the panel for this opportunity to speak before them. I'm a sculptor. I moved here to St. Paul in 1997 with my Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I came here to expand my career in the arts, and I was received and have lived in the same location at 255 East Kellogg Boulevard, downtown St. Paul, in the Lower Town Loft Cooperative for almost 11 years now. In 2001, I won first place in a national competition. I don't want to go over my whole case because my case has not been probable cause or non-probable cause yet. And so I don't want to go through my case. But the biggest thing that I find is that the increase of discrimination against individuals of color in this state. Unfortunately, about 3 weeks ago, every now and then I Google my name to find out what's on the line about my career, because I look on there every now and then, and I find things that, you know, I didn't give the okay for. And recently it's been a case in which I had with the state, where the state attorney's office became involved because I was not given permission to enter a club because of my dress. I'm African American, born Christian, raised Christian. It's nobody's business. But my dress leads to a lot of racism because a lot of people think I'm Muslim. I have nothing against anyone's particular faith. I wear my clothing to relate to my ethnical background. And in this state, it has not been seen as a very positive thing, especially since September 11th. I've been constantly dealing with discrimination. And after winning first place in a competition with the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and then finding out 4 years they refused to show my work. So, they brought me to the Human Rights Commission after remarks that were made by Minneapolis Institute of Art toward my race. There's many, many problems here within the state that need to be resolved. And now is not the time where budgets should be cut for the Human Rights Commission Department, because they do their best, and they do as good as they can for the amount of people that are working and the amount of money that they have. It's not enough. They need more funding. They need more support. Now is the time when the state has to stand up and say, yes, we're going through hard times, but we will not let our civil rights be violated by any citizen that lives in this state. I came here for opportunity. And I'm constantly running into racism because of my appearance. I deal with this every day. I can walk out of my studio and someone will holler up in the window of their car the N-I-G-G word as I walk down the street. This happens. I can walk home and someone will scream across the street at me, go back to your own land. This is what's happening today. This is what I deal with. And I looked on the internet several weeks ago and found out that my case dealing with Smakufa, that I was not permitted into a club because of my dress. So I deal with this constantly. I really want to state that before the panel that you cannot cut. If anything, you need to be adding more staff, adding more funding and resources to the Human Rights Commission, because there's a lot of cases that do not get looked at. I've waited 2 years, almost 2 years, just to have my case looked at. Now, I've just been told that they're investigating my case finally. And I found this out 2 years ago, what was going on. And it just hurt me to go through this whole process, to wait this long to get this resolved. And the deal, if you're going to a museum that has like 26,000 people in the collection, and only 36 of them are African American out of 26,000, this is a serious problem here. You know, and I don't know how my case is going to come out. Like I say, it's still in the process.
Now, Mr. Brown, we have a couple other people who want to speak, so I want you to wrap it up.
But basically, my main thing is funding is what's needed now. Now is not the time for the state to be running and acting like the mass population. Now is when we need to have the threat of these social policies to be backed up with statutes and backed up to where we don't go off and lose footing.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony. Is there anyone else? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Please come up. Oh, we have two more people. So if you just keep your comments to a few minutes because we really need to get over to the Capitol.
I'm Jane Fontaine, and I would... I don't know your protocol, so I'm just going to get to the point. I'm here because I do public relations in the construction industry, and a great big bill is being passed right now, or has been passed, to stimulate our marketplace. And as a person in the community and working as an independent most of my life, in the perspective of the public relations in the construction industry last year, I've been involved with the Association of Women Contractors, the Association of General Contractors, and heard the climate and the atmosphere between the DBEs and the minorities and the contracts that are out there. There's one area that I would address to your committee that would be greatly beneficial to the whole industry as a whole. It would be the words good faith estimate or good faith effort that is in the process of the bidding process right now to get DBEs and the minorities to bid in contracts. One thing that's happening in the industry is that the contractors are being, the major generals are flooding the DBEs and the minorities with faxes to go to them to bid. A lot of time is put into these bids, and then the bids are not being faithfully awarded. And so I know that there's been a lot of talk with the government here on getting it stimulated to the people that can do the work. There's many people that are women and minorities that can do the work in this state that are DBEs and that are minority contractors. And there's a lot of things that have been happening with MnDOT lately. I guess what I would like to see is some form of language changed on this good faith effort, because good faith is too big of a loophole for people to just send an offer out and not comply with getting the jobs procured for us in the industry. And I'm trying to say it really briefly in brief time, but it's a big doorway and a loophole to keep what you're trying to accomplish by your laws to not happen. And the people that would normally come to speak to you, such as the construction workers and so forth, are intimidated, because if they raise their voice, we're in a very competitive industry. It's very easy for somebody to go ahead and raise a voice, and then everybody blackballs you so that you don't work. So changing a law or looking at that as an opportunity to correct something, maybe putting some guidelines in or accountability in MnDOT so that they have the opportunity to go in and make sure that while a project's going, that the DBE numbers are met. My concern as a citizen for even showing up and even speaking is that federal government guidelines put things into place so that the federal money comes to our state. When these guidelines aren't met, then they're going to take the money from us, and we already need the money.
Ms. Fontaine, we have one question, quick question, Ms. Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been trying to figure out for a couple years all the interrelation of the different laws. Is there anything that puts all these laws, any document that puts all the laws together, the federal, state? I think there's even some local ordinances regarding use of minority contractors and then use of minority workers. And it's the second part to the question. It seems like most of the laws are directed towards getting enough percentage of minority contractors, which I brought up at the last retreat for the Council of Black Minnesotans doesn't mean anything, because what we're especially trying to do is get minorities into the trades on government projects and things like that. So I know there's two parts to the question, and we're limited on time. Is there some way you can answer that or get me something?
I am not the person who would have the data that would be able to answer that question for you, but I actually wouldn't mind helping you if maybe somebody is here.
Somebody's pointing.
Tim is somebody that would be able to do that for you. I'm basically speaking as somebody in the industry saying we've got a real... It's to stimulate our economy. It covers all walks of life. It's every race and women and men. And to leave it as it is right now, it's only, again, like the lady said up there, only a certain population is getting the work, and
okay,
all of our money.
Do you want to introduce yourself for the record and be very brief in your response?
I'm Tim Kennedy. I'm a senior business consultant at the Metropolitan Economic Development Association. I work primarily in construction.
Okay.
The short answer to your question, sir, is no. There is no consolidated policy for that. Each municipality, each government entity sets their own rules, often makes their own certification. Those of us that work in this area do our best to make sense of them and consolidate them and help these various governmental entities work in concert to achieve their ends. There is, I should point out, a correlation between minority workforce and minority-owned contractors. That is not, I believe, the intent of the emphasis on buying from minority-owned contractors. That has to do with distributing wealth equally, rather than having just majority-owned companies employing minority workers. We try and get minority-owned companies the actual work. But minority-owned companies do have an effect on minority workforce. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick follow-up. My concern is that meaning a minority contractor may be a correlation, but there's certainly not a direct large correlation, because I remember when I used to do construction law, there were a lot of people who would come in with a person of color or a woman and get them set up as the head of a new construction company, and in essence it would be run by a former white man, and they weren't hiring people of color at all, things like that. So there's an awful lot of ways to get around the fact that we don't have anything as far as actually hiring the workforce that I know of people of color.
Ms. Kennedy.
We do our best to ferret out those. That's an example of exceptional probat theorem. The exception tests the rule, but it doesn't negate the rule. There is a correlation between true minority-owned entities and minorities in the workforce, and that also goes for women-owned companies. And yes, abuses do occur, have occurred in the past as well. We deal with that as best we can. Wherever there's a rule, someone will try and find a way around it.
Mr. Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment to add to some of Mullery's suggestions or concerns. Last year, when we were doing the transportation time, and I brought a amendment to the floor, and in the transportation department, they didn't have nothing in there suggesting, in good faith, to hire communities of color contractors. And I was told at the time that also that the governor had already initiatives put in place that they automatically would have communities of color contract in that. And I haven't seen anything. But I brought that to the floor last year, and it didn't get anywhere because the votes weren't there because of the early initiative, supposedly, of this governor's statement that his staff stating that there was already that provision in there. So to answer his question, I think that it's not in there, and it should be treated a little different. I just wanted to make that comment.
Did you have anything else you wanted to add? We're really running low on time, short on time.
I have one very short thing.
Okay.
The survey is not valueless. There is something in there which I think is important that you should note. and the phrase you heard earlier, impartial adjudicator, is important, because the role of the department is not to be the adjudicator. That is the court's role. Their role is to find probable cause, and although probable is a fungible term, we've also heard from other people that their finding of probable cause has become an adjudication in itself. So the question is where probable should be on a spectrum from we suspect there may be wrongdoing to we're quite certain there should be wrongdoing, and your indication in this report that the line is being drawn in an improper place is that the proportion of cases that go to court that are upheld are very high. If it's high, then we know that there is some data error there, that people who truly have a case are not being put forward, and their cases are not being heard. And that's all I have to say. If anyone, I will leave you a stack of cards if anyone wants this, any information from me on this or any other subject.
Okay. Appreciate your testimony, and I hope we've gotten to everyone who wanted to speak. If there's anyone, if you've got something to say in a minute, you're gonna lose all the members here because we have to go to session. I apologize for that.
Thank you, Representative Paymont, and his honorable body. I'm Boyd Morrison. I just wanted to make a few comments real briefly here in respect for your time, but not in the shortness of the state of Minnesota and the people whose rights that we're talking about here today. I just wanted to make sure that we are truly aware that this department here, Minnesota Department of Human Rights, has the responsibility of all the residents and citizens in the state of Minnesota. I'm saying something that you probably don't know, I mean, if you're unaware, that's not informed by you already, but they are have the responsibility and task of making sure that all the residents in the state of Minnesota's rights is being followed by. I don't know how many employees, staff that the commissioner has there, but we just have to look at those things and make sure that we have ample people in this department to uphold the rights of all the people and individuals in the state of Minnesota. But we don't consider the fact that we need funding for these particular departments to operate effectively and represent the rights of each one of your districts. Then we're not doing a service to the department, nor are we doing a service to the respective people in this particular state. I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we ensure that there is ample dialogue and discussion that is being met and performed that are actively engaged in supporting the Minnesota Department of Rights and within enforcing the human and civil rights laws in the state of Minnesota. I just want to be, again, in closing, being mindful of the fact that I don't know, again, how many staff members that the department has. I do know that ongoing training needs to be implemented from the staff if it's not being done, and also through local commissions and human rights commissions in their efforts. I'm a direct result of some of the efforts and lack thereof efforts from the local commissions that's around the state of Minnesota. The poor training, the lack of attention to details, and or administration and engaging local activities in the local community. I have been serving for 2 years as vice chair, and definitely is this made by some of the lack of effort that goes on there about human and civil rights. So I think that it's very incumbent, again, that we not only just address the proper funding and or the consideration and the fact that this is for our state effort and not just a particular class of people, but it's the entire state of individuals in the state of Minnesota. I just want to just say that and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Morrison. Thank you all who testified, Commissioner, for your department, and we'll be discussing this issue again in the future. I appreciate members' indulgence. This committee meeting is adjourned.